My name's Michael Coates. I'm a former firefighter, but I'm also a former soldier. And it's the stories from the individuals within this military community that I'm desperate to document. In this episode, we speak with a military veteran who is a current serving reservist and army wife. We talk about life in the armed forces and its impact on the family. We also speak about her love for photography and spouse employment. Episode 41, Wendy Four. This is Declassified. Born in 1966, and you had a you was moving about a lot as a child. Where was you born initially?
So I was born. I was initially born.
Yeah.
I was born in Bahrain. Dad was serving over there, and I think it must have been quite a difficult time for my mum. She was 21 in a foreign country in an Arab hospital in the 60s, and I had two of my children in Germany. And friends were able, family were able to come over and help. So I just can't imagine what it must have been like. And she had two, so my sister and myself there, 66 and 67.
So six is it? What? Why was your dad based out there? Because your dad was in.
Yeah. So dad was. That was actually his second tour. He'd been there before during the Suez Crisis, and So he was there on a 2-year tour with the Rimi.
Mm. And then from there, where did you go?
So then we went to Germany for 2 years and then Hong Kong for 2 years. So I didn't live in England until I was six.
Mm. Do you remember the early part then, dear? Do you remember moving about?
I do. I remember it being very stressful. I remember I don't know if I remember it or it's my mum recounting how she travelled with three of us, with my brother who was 6 weeks old, my sister three and I was four, over to Hong Kong on our own. Late 60s, so 69, when we went to Hong Kong, and dad was already there, and he was just like, hello, yeah, and she always recounts the whole, you can have them now.
We'll pass it on.
Yeah.
Your dad spent a long time in, he was in for
38 years, he joined at 15 as a boy soldier in Arborfield, and then went straight over to Cyprus as part of the AOKA, so when I then went and did my tour in Cyprus in 93, I think it was, they came over and I said, oh, we were staying in Ledra Palace, that was our barracks, and he was like, oh god, 5-star hotel, that's amazing. I went, dad, just wait till you get here. Not quite.
And so your full childhood then up until your A-levels, that was all as a military child?
Yeah, moving around every 2 years. I mean, I went to boarding school at 11, just to get that stability. And for me, it was brilliant. My brother and sister hated it. But to then every holiday go over to Germany. And it's all the independence, though, that you learn of going abroad, travelling through London on your own to get up to school in Whitby. And then I'd never forget the movers in RAF Hendon. Bless them. I don't know how they did it. We all gathered at King's Cross. You had to meet. It was almost a bit like Harry Potter. You had to meet at King's Cross. And then they would take you on a coach out to RAF Hendon. You'd then overnight. And then there'd just be a flight of school kids. So there was only like three or four flights at the end of term to get school kids over to Germany. And they would be piled on. And you could just see. I mean, I can't imagine it now. These poor RAF movers going... I didn't join to do this.
What was because a lot of military kids go to boarding school, and you mentioned stability. Do you think it's a good thing? Do you think it is a? I know you said your brother and sister there as well didn't really adapt as well, but do you think it's a good thing to be away from home as young as kind of 11?
It's really difficult, and it's all about individuals and families. But for my children, they were at boarding school. My son went at 11. The youngest went at 8. And she, because the other three were at school, and she just turned around and said, I want to be with my family. And I think if you've got the right school, it is amazing. When I watch my children and what they've managed to achieve, you know, when I was moving around as a child, I was bullied because I had a different accent to people. They had different curriculum. So every time we moved, I was repeating the same thing and doing different syllabus and all of that sort of stuff. And boarding school provided that continuity, and the whole continuity of education, certainly for me and for my children, has been incredible.
Mm. So go keep on, or we'll stay on you for a second as to senior and senior education. Did you thrive with kind of formal education?
Probably not. It only came out when my son was doing his A-levels last year, and he said, I said, you've got to do your best, you've got to work hard. And he said, well, how did you do? I said, that's not the point.
Yeah.
I failed all my A-levels.
Did you?
Yeah. And I remember when I joined the army, and then I was sent on a regimental CAPE tour, keeping the army in the public eye, and we went to schools, and the other officer I was with, and we stood in front of these schools, and this guy would say, yeah, I went to Welbeck, and I got 3 A's, and I did this, and it's perfect, perfect, perfect. And I stood up and said, oh, well, I failed all my A-levels. Then I went to be an au pair for 2 years in Luxembourg. Then I went to art college for 4 years. Then I was a freelance photographer. And then I joined the army.
Yeah. Well, there's a lot of, you know, and I think for anyone, like I didn't do any, I failed everything bar English. That's the only thing I passed in GCSEs. And then gaining experience, because it was your dad's advice to go and see the world, really, or especially experience the world before you joined, because you wanted to join at 16. He said, look, go and do something else. And then going out to Luxembourg to be an au pair, 2 years.
Yeah. So I was with the same family for about 18 months and then just sort of stayed on, really, because I didn't know what I wanted to do. But it was the mother of the family who was a ceramics teacher, and she said to me, because I was doing lots of creative things with the children, and she said, well, why don't you do art? And I said, well, I never did it at school. And she said, doesn't make any difference. So I then went to art lessons in French once a week, and just to get the practice. And then when I went to and did my foundation course and we were being taught perspective, I was just like, I don't understand this. Can you do it in French? Because I'm sure I can understand it better in French.
Was the mother, or the mother of the child who you was being up at, did she teach you, or was it separate?
No, I mean, she just encouraged me. Ah. And that was the beauty of it. I think that with anything like this, and what I've tried to do with my children, is just encourage to do anything and explore. You know, with art, the beauty is that nothing is ever wrong. It's just opinion. And actually, does somebody else's opinion matter? If creatively it's made you feel better and you have got something out of it. And it was one of the big things in when I was doing my degree in Nottingham. And if somebody dropped paint all over the place or did something wrong, we'd all say, photograph it, print it, it's art. Mm. And it's all about opinion. But it's, for the individual, I think the art is about how it makes you feel, whether it's theatre or painting or sewing or embroidery or photography, whatever it is, if it's something creative, is about how it makes you feel at that time.
Mm, and I mean, you know, going and living in Luxembourg and then having that art impact you in a way where then it evoked an action, and that action was to do a 3-year degree.
Yes.
And what was that? What was you doing?
So it was in graphic design.
Yeah.
But I always caveat that with before computers.
All right, okay.
So that's why, in many respects, it was a degree in tracing and colouring in, because I realised that when we were asked to illustrate a project or something like that, that actually it's not that I can't draw, it's I don't enjoy drawing. It doesn't come as naturally to me. So I used to just go and photograph everything. And then I used to love spending time in the dark room and then creating in the dark room, yeah, in the good old days of negatives. And that was brilliant. It was great fun.
What were you doing? What kind of photography were you doing at the time? Did you excel in, or did you prefer one kind of photography to another, or was you just experiments?
I think the joy of it was that because you were illustrating a project, it didn't, you got to experience different. So one of the projects was we had to do a self-portrait without you in it. I was just like, okay. And it just gets you thinking differently and laterally about everything. And then, what was it? I can't remember any of those. But, oh yeah, there was one where we had to, it was a short, we used to get these one day projects, and one of them was to illustrate a particular theme, and everyone was doing these beautiful drawings and illustrations, and I just went outside and drew a hopscotch thing on the floor, took a photograph and printed it up and shoved it on the wall. But it, I was just like, oh, just have done. And actually they said, oh, that's a really good idea. And I was like, oh, okay. but also using photography to document your life. So whatever seems mundane, I know lots of people do it on Instagram now, and they do these take a photo a day. But it's not about just taking a photo a day because someone on Instagram said it's a really good idea. It's about actually why you're taking that photograph. So I always take my phone on a dog walk, and it's not so much because I want my phone on me. It's the camera is so easy to use and that sort of thing. Mm. I hate taking my phone with me everywhere.
Yeah.
Yeah.
But it's got its plus sides. And again, like, I think photography, it's opened up, you know, documenting, even conversations, you know, like there's so many different apps and, you know, different methods of being able to document, and photography is certainly right up there. Everyone's a photographer now. But why did you join the military? Because you ended up joining the military in 91. You went to Sandhurst. What was the thought process behind that?
Oh, it was an itch I had to scratch. I just wanted to see if I could do it. And I remember walking up the steps, you know, after the training at Sandhurst, and the girl that I was walking up the steps with, I said, oh, I've done this now. I don't need to do it. She said, keep walking, just get up those steps. I was like, okay. But it was a challenge. We had a reunion, and if you join Sandhurst Trust, you can get your reports from Sandhurst. And so I got my reports. And I was looking at them, and it actually sent me into a bit of a depression, because it was like, Miss Morton needs to stop talking to the boys, because there's lots of my OTC were there, so I knew them. And they said repeatedly she keeps telling us that she's going to be a troop commander in the artillery, and I've told her she can only be an assistant adjutant, and she wants to take photographs in the army, and I've told her officers don't take photographs. And it was persistent. And there must have been at one point where I just capitulated and said, okay, fine. And because the report says, the interview says, I think I've finally got through to her that she will be just, you know, if she does join the gunner, she'll be an assistant adjutant and she'll never, you know, won't take photographs.
What was the role of women in the military then? Was it open as it is now?
No, no. So when I joined, it was still WRAC. The Women's Royal Army Corps.
Okay.
And when I left, they were going all through that process of allowing women to be actually cap badged into the Royal Signals, the Artillery, whichever, an RLC. It was still fairly limited. Mm. But I was able to be the one on that course who was selected to join the Artillery. Mm. And then when I got my letter from my CEO, having done my young officers course down at Lark Hill, and they said that they were going to put me in as a MLRS troop commander. And the line that I've in it is, we're going to drive a metaphorical juggernaut through DRA's policy about the employment of women and just show that this is an area that could be done, and only history will tell whether it works or not. And so I actually sit back and I watch the employment of women in the gunners particularly just grow and grow, and it's just been brilliant.
And so you was part of that initial cohort then of female officers joining the artillery?
Yeah, so I was number four in, and we all had different roles, and others went on to do the forward observation officer and all of those sorts of things. But I still had this urge to take photographs and to promote the army and to capture and document. And I wanted to join the army presentation team, and they said no. So after 3 years, I left. And then within 2 months, I joined the reserves, and I was in Bosnia with 16 air assaults in Croatia, really, so Ploče, as a media officer, photographing and documenting a deployment.
Mm. And then, so did you stay as a... We'll fast forward a little bit and we'll come back. So you left the regular army in 95. But throughout that period, you was the unit press officer.
Yeah. So again, I was always taking photos.
Is that what it is? Explain what that is. What is the unit press officer? What do you do?
The unit press officer is designed to let the media and the rest of the world know what's going on in a regiment and or battalion, whatever. And it's still a really, really valid role today. And especially on deployments and that sort of thing. But you tend to forget about it when you're in camp or peacetime. But actually, it's crucial because it's that link to the community. It's the link and making soldiers feel good about themselves. And when I was interviewing soldiers who were in the middle of nowhere, building a road or something like that in the centre of Bosnia, and they say, I'm just a plant operator, or I'm just a driver, or just this. And it's just sort of, no, you're not. And everybody has a story. Everybody has a story in them. And soldiers have often challenged me on it. They said, no, we haven't. I can't do anything. And I said, I remember there was one time there was a gunner regiment going off to Cyprus. And I said, just pick anybody and I'll tell you what the story is. So they picked somebody. And he'd been sweeping the floor in Asda and had joined the army and wanted something different and was about to go on the Green Line. I said, and you don't think that's a story that 6 months ago you were sweeping the floor in Asda and now you're going to represent your country as part of the United Nations on the Green Line in Cyprus? Is that not something special?
We have such value in the community, whether it's spouse, whether it's reservist, regular. There's so much value to be had and we often don't see it because we're in, and it sometimes takes either someone to point it out or when you leave and then look back and try and figure it out. And it's a really, really growth promoting thing to do, is to understand what value you sit on. But why did you leave? Because you left at 95. Why was that?
Because I wasn't able to take photographs. I think fundamentally underneath, and because of the upbringing with my parents and that sort of thing, the value of the army and or the services and what it can do to transform people and transform lives and what people can get out of it and to tell the stories. You know, I think as well in the 90s, a lot of it was about soldiers going home and getting into trouble and all that sort of thing, and it then devalued what they actually do, and nobody was really telling the stories on operations. And in those days we didn't have journalists embedded. I mean, lunatics would come over to Bosnia and they weren't forced to embed, so you had the Anthony Lloyds who just say, yeah, I'm in country, and then disappear off.
Do you mean by that? Sorry, what do you mean?
So a lot of people now, because they've grown up with the Iraq, Afghanistan, where journalists went over, were embedded, so they were looked after by the army and were able to go forward. And back at home, you then got to see what soldiers were doing. And so there was that empathy with what a soldier's life was like, because we had embraced the use of media, social media, and all different elements. And back in 95, that wasn't there so much. And I just wanted to tell those stories of individuals and make soldiers feel good about themselves. When you're on ops, the fact that somebody has given you half an hour to talk about your job, so you then understand what your job is. And I always used to see part of my job was almost like a therapy, to make them understand the value that they have in what they consider to be the most mundane of jobs. And it isn't, because it's part of a bigger picture and they've chosen to do it. You know, we have volunteer services and they weren't forced to do it, but they've chosen to take that job and they're doing a brilliant job. And it's all part of a bigger picture. They are a small part of a puzzle, but without that small part, the puzzle doesn't get finished.
So looking back from today when we're recording this, do you have like a stack of photos then?
I have hundreds.
Do you? Yeah. So from the time between 92, 95?
From Sandhurst. I documented all my time through Sandhurst.
Really?
You know, of people falling asleep in lectures. I used to have my camera with me the whole time.
And you was allowed to do that?
Probably technically no.
Yeah.
I don't know. But I did it. And then we did an end of year booklet type thing. But I mean, when I look back at some of the negatives that I've got, I would love to do it as a sort of an insight into what it was like to go through Sandhurst, but I'd have to get permissions, and I don't think some of the people.
Yeah.
But put it this way, Sharon Naismith was in my intake.
These, because I'm fascinated with documenting these stories. Like, of course, you know, that's why we're sat here now, and we've done 40 odd hours so far. But leaving then, because what was the reason why you couldn't take photos then?
Well,
did you move into a different role or something?
They wanted, at that time, it was all about women being seen to be doing. And because I'd had this job as an MLRS troop commander, they wanted me to go and be an FOO. And it was almost like those of us who were pioneers, inverted commas, were then being put forward as poster girls. And it was just like, do you know what? I just want to be in the army. I don't care about being the best or being on a pedestal. I just want to do a job and I want to be a part of this. And they weren't letting me do it. I can't remember who it was who said to me at the time, have you heard of the TA, public information officers? And I said, no, never heard of them. And looked them up, and within months I was joined up into the reserves and deploying out.
So was it an easy transition then out and then straight into reserves?
Yeah.
Did you
thing I've ever done. I've done in the army all the things I ever wanted to do. All the things I've wanted
to do. In the reserve?
Yeah.
Go on. So from transition then, so you're a regular?
Yeah.
Are you with your husband at this point? 95?
No. So funnily enough, we were at Sandhurst together. So right. We trained alongside each other. And so we knew of each other. He always says, if you asked him, he'd say, oh, she didn't know me. And I'd say, 600 boys, 60 girls? I'm not going to narrow it down to one. Yeah. So actually, it wasn't until I left the regulars, I'd been to Bosnia, and I came back, and I was part of the training team who were then training the next Roermond of guys going out. And I was in Senlager. And in my regular service, I spent all my time in Senlager, and the light infantry were in Paderborn. He was light infantry. And so I knew them. And they said, what are you doing back? Coming to a party, blah, blah, blah. And then we sort of met and married in a year.
Mm.
So there are no secrets.
Yeah. You married 97. You've been in reserve for 2 years.
Yes.
Was you employed as well, or was you just... Was you just working as a reservist?
So I had... No, when we... Just before we got married, actually, I thought I'd come across my ideal job. It was working for a charity that I was employed as their media officer to go overseas. So I was going to go to the Congo. So I had all the inoculations and visas to go through Rwanda. I mean, this is in 96. And into the Congo to support these medical, it was like an English version of Médecins Sans Frontières, and do the media side for them. But every time I asked and I said, so what about Land Rover and radios and what happens, what's the CONOPS, you know, if something happens, what will I do, how do I get out? And they said, oh, no, you're on your own because the doctors have the Land Rover and the radio. You'll just have to go. And I was like, oh, I don't think so. And that's when I realised, you know, so that value of being able to take risk in the military, because you have that backup. There's a whole system of backup behind you. And that realization that there wasn't that backup just made me shy away, really.
Mm. You stayed, or you're still in the reserve. You're still a reservist now.
Yeah.
But you're also a military wife. A military spouse. You have four children born 2000, 2001, 2004, 2005. So really at the start of a lot of the conflict that we were facing from Iraq and Afghanistan, 2003, your husband was involved with Talik 3, and it was the back end was fairly brutal. And what was it like being at home when things were going on out there with the little ones? Did you feel like there was good communication going on?
It was quite difficult, actually. I think the joy was the bluey. And I know it sounds really bizarre, very old-fashioned, but the process of writing a letter and sealing it and sending it off and someone receiving it, I've still got all the blueys from all of that time. And then towards the end of the operations when he was on Herrick 19 and the blueys sort of dwindled because the connectivity was there, so people were able to FaceTime or you could send emails and that sort of thing. There's an element that was lost, and I think that's such a shame. So in that sort of historical process, almost, that therapy of writing something down and working it through in your head and then putting it onto paper and getting rid of it and then sealing it and posting it, there's an awful lot within a letter that is so much more than just writing to somebody. Mm. And with technology, you lose that. And you can't, with FaceTime, it's there. Yes, you see them, but then what do you do 5 minutes later? With a letter, you can write, you can read it again and again, and I still have all of mine.
You can try and find hidden messages, not so much cryptic, but, you know, like emotional messages, where if someone's, how someone's feeling, especially if you know that person really well. A lot of guys who I know now use their blueys and letters home to start writing their book as well. And if we don't do things, like we don't get those kind of habits, those positive routines, and like writing, for example, is very therapeutic as well, and like offloading, we lose that documentation of it. You know, we really do lose something special there. And I've got hundreds in my loft of the blueys from Telic 1, and I've not read them for years, but that's another story.
That's your book for later.
Yeah, that's the later book. It was quite stressful though, before, well, especially during and immediately after. And did you as an individual, and did the children, we don't want to go into too much with your husband's situation there with his men and whatnot, but was he a lot of stress on the household?
I think it was strange because we'd been through the same training at Sandhurst, and I didn't deploy to Iraq or Afghanistan, but I knew the procedures and I knew what was happening and I knew the formats, and I, as part of my job, I had documented all the training and that sort of thing. So you get to know the people and you get to know the characters and you know the procedures. And so some of it, you get a comfort in the fact that actually they're trained and you know they're trained and they're going to rely on their training, and that's why we do it. And I used to try and explain to spouses, you know, okay, so they're away a lot before they deploy, and yes, it's frustrating, but by doing that repetitive, it becomes instinctive, and that's what you need when it's in a difficult situation. I think a lot of people didn't like the way that we shared quite a lot of information. But I find that quite reassuring because then I could understand it.
Between you two?
Yeah, yeah.
Husband and wife, that sharing of information.
Yeah, so he would, because he was company commander, he would send me the detail of events on the basis that I then knew ground truth, so that if something was talked about back at home, I could then sort of say, no, actually, that's not true. I know that's not true. This is or elements of what did happen. Mm. And that's, I think that was easier than for him, because he could actually say to me exactly what happened. You didn't have to fluff around it or pad it out. Yeah. It was actually ground truth. And I think that's really important. And that's why it's so important, you know, when guys come back, is that they stick with the people who they deployed with, because they can talk ground truth. They don't have to say, oh no, it's fine, it didn't matter, or, you know, something happened, and just gloss over it, but they can actually talk about what really happened and what it was they were involved in. because if you don't, then you bottle it up, and then that's when the issues start. So I think in some ways it was helpful, but then for me, I sort of processed it as a soldier, I suppose, but then had to convert it around as a wife and as a mother to then tell the children. So tell it one, it was all about Daddy was going off to catch a bad man. And I'll never forget it. We had one of these BFBS live connections, you know, that they used to do. And the news came on, it said they'd found and captured Saddam Hussein. And my son turned around to me and said, does that mean Daddy's coming home? Mm-hmm. And I was like, no, because that bad man had lots of bad friends. And so Daddy's got to stay and catch those bad friends. It was just those sorts of things.
Well, and that's it. I think we lose track of that sometimes, where we have to explain things in a way. And we don't know the answers. I've had to explain something to my children recently that in the future is going to be very upsetting for them. And that thought process, because they would have been about the same age as yours are here, it can upset them in different ways. And we don't know the answers. We don't know the answers. We don't know how to explain that to our children when they need us. And you've just got to kind of do your best. Yeah. But was you sharing that information between the other spouses as well? Was it coming together as a community when people were leaving and going on operations?
So one of the things I did on Telic One was I absolutely, fundamentally believed that we should keep the spouses informed as to what was happening. And so I set up a whole little system of getting photographs in and going to coffee mornings or whatever else where there were groups of spouses together. And I didn't put it in front of them, but it was, if you want to see how they're living and explain more about what they're doing, I can do it. And I used to just sort of translate it into wifey speak. Mm. And that became my sort of forte. So I then worked on all the rear ops and was that link between the military and the families. So on Telic One, there was nothing to support the families. Now we sort of take it for granted. So Patrick Marriott was the chief of staff of One Div when they deployed and I was doing all this work. He went to 7th Brigade and set up Home Rat. And so then all this rear op support for families kicked in. And I sort of take pride in the fact that actually it was I walked into the divisional headquarters and I said, you need to tell the families what's going on, how to keep them informed, and I will do that. And they went, okay.
It was a tough time. My mum had a real breakdown on Telic One. You know, I was 19 and she had no real communication. She didn't know what was going on. She had a real, real tough time of it. And the communication is so important. It can be like, but I mean, yeah, Telic was a weird one because it was quick and everyone was out and it was ill prepared. There was a moment in 2015, so we've jumped a lot, where you thought yourself as just a wife. And it was an impactful kind of realization. How did we get to that point where you was just a wife?
So I had spent, we lived in Germany for 16 years and I'd spent all my time supporting all these different deployments. So obviously supporting the deployments meant my husband was deployed and I did the media on the rear ops. And I'd got to a position, I think, where people would just say, actually, I'll do whatever she says, because I was a trusted person when it came to the media and communicating what the army wanted to communicate. And the last job was with 7th Brigade with the Desert Rats. We did 75th anniversary. We did final parades of leaving Fallingbostel and Hona. And we then moved down to Paderborn and I offered to work. And I said, you know, I can work 3 days a week because my children are priority. I can only do that. And they said, well, it's full time or nothing. And I said, well, it's nothing. And so all of a sudden I had moved house. So it's a new community. It's no job and all my children were away at school. And I was just sort of, what do I do? There is, you know, I can't do anything. There is nothing I can do. And I went to a party and it was probably some mess do or something. And someone asked me, what did I do? And I said, well, I'm just a wife. And I was so, so cross with myself that I then started to ask people what they did. So I started with Kelly, who worked at the cinema. And I just said to her, you know, what do you do? And she said, I run the cinema. I said, no, what did you do before you met your husband? And she was trained as a criminologist. And then it just started. Everybody I spoke to, so it wasn't about, you know, interviewing 2,000 and selecting the top 50. It was the first 50 people that I spoke to who I just asked the same questions, and they came back with these answers. And these, just everybody is an incredible person. They've all got these stories that we just see them as wife of so-and-so or a dependent. And it couldn't be further from the truth. And the value that they could bring to the military community is just so overshadowed and overlooked.
Do you feel that that was a cause of just thinking then, I'm just a wife? And obviously that there was the job role was not flexible enough for you to work, which is its own issues, you know, flexible working, especially with mums or dads who were looking after children. Things are changing slowly there. Like, I think it's getting better and better, but yeah, the flexible working and being a bit more accommodating. I suppose my point there is, how did you then get out of that? So you're asking all these questions, and I agree, I think there's an asset, a huge asset with the military spouse with regards to employment. But how did you then drag yourself out of that kind of way of thinking?
And actually, the term drag yourself out is so, so true. I mean, my self-esteem was rock bottom. It was just that I felt I had no value. I, as a person, nothing that I had done was significant because it had all been in uniform. So therefore, I couldn't do anything outside of uniform. I had to wear a uniform in order to be that person who can do the media. And I had a few friends who were brilliant. That community are brilliant, who just would sit down and talk me through, not about military, but about the skills and what the skills were, the photography, the interviewing, the stories, the putting them together. And there was that realization that actually, yeah, for the last 23 years, I have been doing this, and it's a skill that I could use and apply to the spouses. And every significant birthday, I try to do something. And when I was 40, I'd sent a box of chocolates to 40 women who had made an impression on my life. And so I wrote and told them what it was. And so when I hit 50, I thought, actually, this is my community. And I want to talk about my community, which are the spouses. And everyone was just fascinated. I'm glad I didn't sort of video it, because my face, you know, is jaw dropping half the stories. Mm. And there's lots of tears, there's lots of laughter. But fascinating, fascinating stories.
Mm. With your art now, with your photography, how is it making an impact with the spouse community? What are you doing now to, because it's such a powerful, your work is so powerful, and it's so, is it evocative or what? Not evocative, like it evokes emotion. What are you doing?
The way that I see the exhibition is actually, it's a tool, and it's like any art, is a tool to get people talking, and to, they can talk about the photographs, and they can talk about the narrative that goes alongside the photographs, and then that opens up the conversation, because they're talking about either a comment or they want to know more about it. So then that conversation has just been opened up massively about spouses. So I'm persistent on LinkedIn and things like that, where it says these courses are open to veterans and spouses and spouses, because actually when someone is injured or is going through that transition out of the military for whatever reason, the reliance, they're going through a huge change. They've probably spent 10, 16, 20 years in an institution where everything is formatted, but it's been the person who's moved alongside them who has had to sort out the new community, to sort out where they're going to go, what they're going to do, and the resilience and all of those things. So a spouse has that ability to, it's just another move when you leave the army for them, because it's another, right, okay, we're going to settle here, I've got to get a job, I'm going to sort out where all the schools are and all that sort of thing. They've been doing that every 2 years for their whole married life. for the serving person, they've always moved into a set of colleagues, into a job that they know, into a situation that they know with the, you know, standard operating procedures, the standard operating instructions, with defence instruction notices. You know, there's all sorts that just supports them. And to then go out into civilian life where there isn't that is quite a shock. But part of what I would love to see is that actually this career transition partnership is shared with the spouse. So if the spouse has been a lawyer but has given it up because they followed the spouse around for 16 years, well, why can't the wife who's going to has that earning greater earning potential allowed to have that training in the last 2 years so that she can get into, or he can get into that position where they then become the main earner as the person coming out of the services finds that work-life balance and does that move out, because it is completely different.
You're talking about resettlement.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, that resettlement piece should be, it's a family thing. It's not a serving person event. It's a family event. And even if it's, you know, someone who's a single serving person, there's still other ways that they can be supported into those different workplaces.
Mm. How's it changing? What have you seen, especially since 2015? Have you seen change four years ago?
Yeah, yeah, yeah. And especially in sort of Gemma Wright and the work that she's doing with the National Health Service, the Step Into Health. Mm. There are Barclays in Scotland open up all of their courses that are open to veterans, open to spouses now. And I think that's all we're asking. We're not asking for anything new. We're not asking for handouts or anything else. It's just like, see us as a family and see us as a unit. And actually, it's the whole unit that is going through resettlement. And it could be that the spouse has a greater earning potential. I mean, there's lots of people who will admit, serving people who say, oh, actually, do you know what? It's my wife who is the big hitter in this and can earn much more than I can. And why not? But that's all supporting them leaving. And it just buys that time for the family to rejig and resettle and sort themselves out.
We are in a time where we can, or remote working is a real option. Flexible working is a real option. And it's true. You know, this stuff happens. My small company, we have 9 now, 8 veterans, 1 military spouse. Well, we got Amy through Recruit for Spouses with Helleth. And we had 3 candidates, I suppose, within 24 hours. And I think I've said this on here before, maybe on the Forces, where the caliber was so high. It was shockingly high. But any of the 3 would have done a great job. I mean, it was really remarkable. That's why I'm such an advocate for spouse employment. Not because there's a pity thing, not because there's a victim thing. It's because there's an asset, like you have, there's a talent pool. And if a company can start figuring, especially remote working, and understanding the hardship on ops. But actually, it's not the on ops the problem. It's when, there's no problem with being on ops, because actually you get more of a dedicated, focused individual because they throw themselves into work. But it's understanding when they come back that they might need flexibility with leave periods and things like that. And these are all simple things to deal with. What's your role now? Because you're still a reservist, like we've said. What are you doing now?
I'm stepping into community engagement and the arts, and it's about how we can use the arts within the military and get those links across. But I don't think it's just about into civilian community. I think also if we can develop the arts within the current serving soldiers, then it's just another element. It just uses a different part of the brain, and it's using that creativity, which then develops that lateral thinking, which develops that mission command that is so important to, and the imaginative thinking that the British Army is renowned for. And by using the arts, we can do that. And it's not anything about being woozy or anything like that. Mm. It's actually, you know, when we look back, we were talking earlier about the letters, those sketches that were done in World War I, World War II, or earlier, you know, the recce guys, we didn't have cameras or anything else. It was a pen and a paper.
The poetry.
Yeah.
The writing, some of the writing's amazing.
Exactly. So it's all about bringing those skills back in and seeing it as an integral part. I mean, what recce soldier, every recce soldier should be a really good artist. And it's not that, oh, I can't draw or anything. Everybody can draw. It's one of those skills that is taken out of us because we've got to learn to read and write and to do maths and do science and that sort of thing. And why not sewing? We had soldiers on the Great Sewing Bee, you know, and there's all sorts of different ways that people can be creative. And to integrate those elements of the arts into not only recovery programs, which I've done before in the past in Germany, but also in serving life, then it's that value, it's that self-esteem, it's that ability to create and produce something that is good. And that signature thing is that taking that ownership of that piece of work.
I think what the military is getting very good at, the veteran community is getting increasingly good at, and it's, and there's a crossover, is mindfulness, is thinking outside the metaphorical box, is trying new things, especially, and I think a lot of it's come from recovery, like long-term recovery, and not, again, not the war me attitude, but just like a tool in the box to be able to unlock, whether it's painting or photography or knitting, whatever it is. Like, I know lots of people doing this kind of stuff. What do you think the future is going to be with the arts, with the military? I know we've just discussed your role, but where do we want to be with this long term?
I think that the arts is a great way of people talking about everything, whether it's the recovery journey, whether it's the journey into the forces, you know, using the arts to talk about what people, communities think about the military and how they see it, because it's easy enough when, you know, the perception of the military when we were in Iraq and Afghanistan was really good and it was high value and that sort of thing. And when we haven't got those operations as kinetic and that sort of thing, people, it goes out of the media. But actually, we've got soldiers all over the world. We still have soldiers all over the world. We've got defence attachés in the most amazing places. And art can bring communities together. So it doesn't have to be about sending out short-term training teams to try and settle something. Actually, it could be about bringing the civilian communities together to discuss what the issues are. I think there's so much. And I know the Israeli army uses the art a lot. I mean, I met a lady years ago, and it was because her father had been in Bergen-Belsen as a prisoner, and he was Jewish, and they went to Israel afterwards when they were released. And she now does art with Israeli soldiers, and it's almost compulsory when they come off that they do something creative for a week before they are then can go home, because it's almost like that. You think about Cyprus, the British soldiers, you know, would go and they would have enforced fun sort of thing. Actually, some of them don't want to do sports. Some of them maybe just want to sit down and have that space to write or to draw or to just go for a walk and photograph or just go for a walk and then come back and create something. There's so many different ways that we can use the arts, and yeah, hopefully I'll be able to get a couple in.
I'm sure you will, and I think it's going to be such an important part. We're at the Invictus Trials. You know, it's 2019. Already, we're seeing conventional art, as in painting, photography, performing art. You know, we were discussing, if we haven't already, we'll be discussing this in this podcast. And it's so important, I believe, and it's a great transitional piece into kind of meaningful employment as well. Wendy, thanks so much, and we will leave it there.
My pleasure.